Hello, and welcome to Mondays on Tuesday. This week it's on Wednesday. Something came up in the first, or maybe this is the second episode that I did, and I said something like, the podcast where nothing ever happens on time. And it kind of stuck. I thought that was interesting. Because let's face it, things don't usually happen on time, from having your kitchen remodeled, catching the bus. Most things don't actually, in fact, happen on time. And that may be the difference between a hobbyist and a professional. A hobbyist is someone who can do things once in a while. Once in a while, predictably in terms of time. Whereas a professional is someone who can deliver the consistency of results that make people come back and plan their day around it. They're going to stop by that restaurant because they know they can count on the consistency of the food. It's not like one of their line cooks is going to wake up in a bad mood. Same thing with the products you buy to do things around your house, the couch you sit on, the car you drive. Everything that's made by a professional is not any different than someone would do as a hobbyist, but it is something you can count on. And I'll talk a bit about things you can count on and why that's important. And this episode is going to be somewhat interesting because I'm going to talk about the reason that I started Compare Basic and the reason I've gone to such great lengths to continue working on Compare Basic. Some of them because you could say I'm a risk-taking, dauntless, self-starting, all the good things individual. And the other thing you could say is that the economy is fucked. And so I fall into the category of a somewhat involuntary entrepreneur with a resume that looks like Swiss cheese because I could do that in software. And now I am trying to career pivot quite literally against nuclear scientists who have lost grant money. So it's kind of like, wow, of all the random resumes we have from people that are career pivoters now, this guy named Firecrow looks kind of unimpressive. So it has been a very interesting few weeks. I actually skipped the podcast last week because I was so busy. And if I'm being honest, I was pretty upset. And what had happened basically was the demo ran, and then I found a number of structural things. Things I had kind of said, well, I don't really have to polish that. And then turns out I had to. Everything from really core stuff. The memory manager, the socket queuing manager for the web server. I realized these are technical things that may not mean anything. But I thought it might be about time to talk about what Compare Basic is, what the Seneca runtime is, why am I building another software language in a time of so many? What is it about a back-to-basics approach that stitches together every component of the runtime in a way that you can see and diagnose and debug and audit and understand? And how could that influence the communication between developers and a phrase that I'm not super fond of, non-technical digital business professionals? And then how could that increased communication and clarity and interactivity and the understanding of how to use tools of patterns lead to a better business climate and environment? And to explain a lot of that, I have to go into psychology a bit, but actually the economy and economics and weird things like what money is. And so I'm going to do all that in this podcast. By the end of this podcast, you will have my nearly complete, though somewhat subjective, answer to what is going on in the software industry, why it is a whole lot more intense than just a bunch of COVID overhiring, and AI is, in my opinion, a minor role in terms of what's going on, and what is going on broadly in the economy and how that affects society somewhat. I won't get super into that, but and then why I really think Compare Basic has a lot of opportunity and a lot of good answers to those things. And my name is Firecrow Silver Knight. I'm your host. Hold on if you can. All right. The chimey industrial iron metal I-beams being clanked together by a giant from the 90s has led our way into this conversation. So I'm going to start with my story a little bit. Hopefully it's brief. And so I grew up in a fairly small town in the state of Iowa in the United States of America. And a population of about 10,000 people. But interestingly, most of them were from the East Coast or West Coast of America. And they had come there to... it was kind of a time in the 70s where people were moving to chase their dreams, following spiritual things. And so this community was kind of a weird, somewhat Midwestern in terms of how I grew up, but also somewhat coastal. So like kind of like big money, but also alternative. And so it was just kind of like a lot of contrast, you know, growing up in an environment of people from somewhere very different. And then when I was 19, I really wanted to be a rock star. That's actually when I changed my name legally to Firecross overnight. And so I went to New York at 19, and it was very clear music was not a game I could win quickly. And so I ended up filing papers, answering phones, and doing kind of administrative organizational stuff in New York City, mostly for entertainment companies. One of the things I will never know is... did my name get me to work at only entertainment companies, or was that staffing agency well connected to entertainment companies? One of many things I'll never know. But you know, it was very large corporate offices. The brand names were, you know, Giorgio Armani, Atlantic Records, Warner Music Group, Estee Lauder, Bobby Brown. So these are all fashion, cosmetic, very sort of large corporate companies. And what I loved the most, I absolutely loved this about working there, was how organized everything was. I mean, it's just like, I was like, I understand why companies run the world, because they dot the I's and cross the T's, and there's someone for every task. And that was really a point of inspiration for me. However, I did leave and decide that I wanted to do something more creative, and I had done 3D graphics, you know, from the age of 10, and then audio engineering and video and some 3D modeling, animation, made a lot of spaceships. And so I decided to go into software. I thought it was, you know, a good idea. So I got some books, spent a large amount of time. I actually got some contracts that I was unable to finish, and that was, you know, somewhat ugly. But it got me my first programming job, and then that got me my next programming job, and then I was off the races as a software engineer. And I then spent 15 years in the software industry, and what I noticed was that in the early days, around like, I don't know, from like 2009 to 2012 maybe, there was such an outflow of creativity. This was the days of... Agile hadn't really been discovered yet, but there was this, you know, may the best idea win no matter who it came from. And, you know, all that, like, you know, interesting creative stuff. We were all learning how to write this and how to write that. And then something shifted, in my opinion, around like 2012-ish, kind of 2011. I remember meeting the developers who came to New York and went to a user group who had created a templating system at their college newspaper. The system was named Django. It was a Python system. And at that time, there was another system, maybe a little earlier than this, that had become incredibly popular called jQuery. And these two systems represented the consolidation of programming into like library, template-y, things you don't write, you just sort of call and give them instructions. And that's kind of like, instead of it doing one thing, it'd do many, many things on your behalf. And the reason I chose these two, I mean, obviously there was tons of them. There was some funny one with a T, and then, you know, Tornado Web, and a whole bunch of PHP stuff, Drupal, I think WordPress. I mean, there were so many of them. I think Prototype was one back then, and so many of them. Backbone, I think, was the name of one of them. You can't say programmers aren't very good at coming up with funny names. But the reason I chose these two, Django and jQuery, is because jQuery's approach was, you will do exactly what you were going to do in 10 lines, but you can do it with one in jQuery. But it doesn't change the way you think about what you're doing. And Django was the complete opposite of that. Django was, you're going to think completely inside out as you used to. You're going to hook little components, and we're going to route them around, and they're going to generate stuff, and we'll automatically populate the data relationships in the database for you using an object relational model. And I think, to me, these represent two completely opposite approaches to software. Does the tool kind of like the difference between a screwdriver and a power drill with a screwdriver head? You do exactly the same thing, but with more power. Or is it more like a printing press, which is so fundamentally different than writing out something on paper? Now you put it through a machine and the ink splats, and it's totally different. And I would call the Django version the sort of configuration-driven version. And I would say the jQuery version is a lot more of the library version, where the library does what you would have done anyway, whereas the configuration version, you're configuring something that does. Who knows exactly how it does it? It's very inside out. So over the course of my career, as these things became introduced, people started downloading more and more stuff, and things got more and more layered, and they stacked up a lot. And I started noticing that we were actually being asked to re-implement the same stuff over and over again. And there were certain things, no matter how many tools we wrote, that just were not that easy to do. Like, I felt like towards the end of my 15-year career, that I was officially working for companies by like 2021, I felt like I had become less creative the way I was at the beginning of my career, and a lot more like a mason, like someone who's asked to take plaster and smear it on a wall the same way they had done for, you know, a few decades. And the reason for that is that there wasn't sufficient understanding between necessarily developers, but also the business layer above us, that it wasn't necessary to re-implement everything all the time. We actually could have been creating our own libraries that became core competencies for the business that would automate away repeatable tasks, because computers are fundamentally automation systems. And there was a project I was on where I proposed a contextual manager that would basically change the website to something that you add information to something that would store everything you did, and then someone else could see it the same way. And this basically would have created kind of a Google Docs style experience where everyone can see where everybody's cursor is and kind of thing for the system. And I had a way of doing it, and it was a schema that I presented, and there was some excitement about it, and then it got cut for time and we never built it. And then a few years later, it was very necessary. We ended up like strapping it in like kind of an awkward way. And my career was kind of, I don't know, that was actually a fairly common experience where I would propose or advocate, hey, what, you know, if we build this thing, it can get us ahead in this way. And it would only go so far and then get shut down. And around this time, what was happening was, from the days of 2012-ish with like jQuery, Django, and Backbone, we had gone through tons and tons of versions of frameworks and libraries that then even got more and more complicated than that. And by the time we got to about 2021, what I observed was happening was that there were so many libraries and so many different libraries that what we spent the most of our time on was library babysitting, where if you add a component to a site, it works in a certain way. It accepts a certain kind of data and needs to be configured in a certain way. You add a different one that's very different. Now you have to coordinate between the two. You add another one, the time that you have saved on the third one, you may actually be losing by needing to coordinate three different things. And I think that what the pattern at that time for companies was, you create an MVP that doesn't do a whole lot, and you go out to customers and you get feedback. And part of the way you get the MVP out fast is by cutting out things that are hard to do. And my interpretation was, people would always come back and be like, yeah, no, we need that hard thing that you avoided. And so now Pressure's on, money's arrived, customers have demands, and you're scrambling. And what do you do if you're scrambling? Well, now that you have money, you hire a bunch of people. The inherent scenario that I saw play out was that those people came with their own preference of little libraries. And so the hiring process of bringing more engineers into the room, more voices, actually slowed things down even more. And now the companies are chasing this top-heavy, complex situation. And as I watched this evolve, COVID hit. And hiring went nuts. I mean, people, like, it was like, oh my God, everyone's online, everyone's at home. And then when COVID was over, companies began shedding employees, and the story they told was, oh, it was, you know, COVID over hiring. And I knew there was more to the story. And then what became popularized shortly after that was the term enshittification, about how the quality had dropped, the switch to subscription model had broken the faith and trust in consumers. But what I had a really strong feeling had actually happened was that the quality of the systems had degraded because the operational business model of download a bunch of stuff from the internet, cobble it together, rush it out the door, put a whole bunch of pressure, hire a whole bunch of people, and then try and dig yourself out of that hole. It seemed very inverted to me. And so when I was laid off at the end of 2022 while working in England, I did go and find one other small company to work for, and I built some really interesting things, and there were a lot of good things about that experience, but it was brief and they were a very small team. And after that was over, it was like the middle of 2022. And I just thought, I got to build something like this. There's something about this way of working that doesn't seem to do what, you know, I think it could. And so I had been kicking around various languages, and I was like, I'll write a language, I'll make a data visualization product, I'll use some crypto algorithms. I've delivered products in 3 months before, or you know, I have 3 months severance from the company. Let's go. And that was 2 years ago. And what I found out even more than that was that my heart and soul was not just in building a system that would be consistent and powerful and start to lessen the gap between business and technology, but I actually was very interested in getting down to the roots of the struggle that I had seen in the business world alone, in business culture, how teams are formed and managed, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So the Seneca system actually is, soup to nuts, everything you need to launch a website with sending emails in one system. Including a replacement for a database, a memory manager so that it's not tied to any single operating system and actually sits outside of Malloc, and data structures that make the process of programming far more intuitive because they have a lot to do with iteration and the sequence and patterns of things. And it all works. So this thing is set to rival somewhat of like an entire Django system, including the Python layer, including the Nginx server, including the PostgreSQL database, all in one place, because the template language is built in because it's fundamentally a domain-specific language parser. Now, I hesitate to call out all of those names. That's an analogy of the kind of thing it is. There are many, many features in Python, Nginx, and Django that this does not have. It's around 180 components. Most of them are, you know, less than 200 or 300 lines long. I mean, it's a very small system, but I built it to basically solve the issue of using systems that are hard to audit because I feel like the black boxy nature is not wonderful. I wrote it to solve the problem of engineers having a hard time communicating with each other because the systems reference crazy models instead of being like, hey, this pattern has like a series that goes forward and backward. Like I wish we could talk about software as if we were all four-year-olds. like what would it be like if you took away all the crazy inheritance, polymorphism, function dispatching method, object property, where just like, you know, I have a bunch of named stuff and I need to take the named stuff and put it in order. right? That makes sense. That makes sense. Or, yeah, well, you know, as we go through the tree, we're just going to like save where we are and then kind of go back to it. Like I feel like this way of talking that doesn't really assume that there is some, you know, crazy complexity to the situation is so much more advisable. And so every step of the way I've tried to make components that build on other components, that build on other components, all of which are easy to understand. And I think that idea of kind of a back to basics, walk before we run, sort of little bit at a time, I think there's tremendous power in that, especially as it embraces the sort of configurable nature of domain-specific languages, but also the concept that a computer system is always in motion. I've always felt like object-oriented programming assumes that computers are made of like tables and chairs and refrigerators and cups and like stuff that you could relate to. And I don't think that's really true. And I think that software engineers think of things in terms of physical objects to their own detriment, because it's less like a picture and more like a movie. And it's in motion that it makes a much more sense to deal with it in terms of, you know, spaces and levels and things like that. So that's the sneaker system. And in order to explain why I think it can help the business community and society so much, I'm going to talk about the basic economics of our worlds with an asterisk, which is this. I'm not an economist. I have found researching the economy incredibly confusing. And if you have too, I totally relate to that. I have a very hard time understanding why dollars and cents can be so confusing. Because to me, I have a dollar, I spend a dollar, it just went somewhere. Why the mystery? But what I will say is the best of my research has revealed that we have an economic system that is designed to consolidate choice into a few hands. And I'll talk about the parts that are confusing and give some options of the various things I have, and I'll do some research, gather the places I have read things. I don't have them at hand now because, you know, I'm not a journalist. I'm just a, you know, random podcaster on the internet for now. And I will put them in the comments later. But I want to talk about the economy from two extreme perspectives. The first perspective is as like the greedy business person. And then the other perspective is as like the sort of artsy-fartsy slacking freeloader. And these are generally the two pictures of humans in the economy that we get, right? If you're pro-business, you seem to think that everyone else is just, you know, sitting around their kitchen baking granola, you know, hugging trees, and I don't know what like free market business people think of the rest of the world. And if you're someone who has experienced the pain and unfairness of what it's like working in this economy, you imagine that there are just greedy people everywhere taking your money. And I think that the reality is not actually somewhere in the middle. It's kind of like in a different universe. And the way I would introduce what this is, it is basically actually to introduce a different concept. I realize this is going to get a little abstract, but bear with me for a second. So I want to talk about the idea of democracy versus non-democracy. So what's the value in giving everybody a choice? And what I would say is that the phrase that I go to the most about this that means the most to me is the phrase of, oh, they woke up on the wrong side of the bed today. And I think the reason, the fundamental argument in my mind for democracy is that it protects everyone, including the individual themselves, from waking up on the wrong side of the bed and just doing like really terrible things. To me, when things are done in a group, I don't have a negative connotation of the phrase designed by committee, because my experience has been that when I have to explain something, it clarifies it. You know, they say if you really want to know something, you should teach it. And because of that process, when you have to explain something and put it up in front of people and really get recognition for it, I think it clarifies what you're doing. And it generally, the things that a lot of people want are good things. and the things that only one person wants tends to be a really bad thing. Now, there's an extreme amount of irony in me saying this, because I have just spent the last 2 years building a system by myself because I feel like, you know, nobody else can see it. And what I would qualify with here is that unique and individual perspectives can in fact be new. But if I really wanted to not have the Seneca system, the compare basic concept, be something recognized and verified by a big group, I wouldn't be talking to you right now on this podcast. I fully expect everything I do to go in front of a lot of people. And if I can't get it to a place where a lot of people can all say, yeah, that's cool, then I haven't really hit the mark. And that's why I really believe in the goodness of groups of people. I think that in general, that spark of humanity, as well as the sort of, you know, horrible, sinister cruelty, is in everyone. And it's in groups that magical things happen. The projects that outlive a human lifespan is the railroads, the highway system, the discipline of law, the discipline of economics, the discipline of education. And a number of these things are incredibly wonderful. The sciences. And if you consider that the most wonderful things in the world have happened over more than a single human lifetime, inevitably it involves groups of people. So I firmly believe democracy is a wonderful thing, and that group decisions are one of the best ways to verify and validate the best thing to do, even though at times developing them individually or in smaller groups can kind of free it of the chains of you know, what's convention, and the convention people are holding on to and the popularity people are holding on to without questioning it. I think that for really important decisions, for really big things, bringing it to a committee or a large population to reflect on is absolutely the best approach. The reason I'm talking about this in terms of the economy is because I feel like when it comes to economics, one of the things that has happened to the software world in a lot of areas of the economy is that the dollar itself has become kind of fake. And what I mean by that is that to the extent that money represents a service someone has provided or a product someone has provided that has that inherent value, that money is real. To the extent that money is for a subscription for something that never changes and you don't really get your money's worth, and then you forget that it's on your credit card and they keep billing you, that money is fake. And to the extent that you buy a bicycle from a shop and bring it home and the wheels fall off and you never get to ride it, that the money you spent has, the value of that money is fake. And so to me, the realness of money is very much tied to, are you getting your money's worth or more from what you spend? And are you giving it to someone whose services and products you appreciate? And that's kind of like a vote. Or is your money going to people because you have no other option? Because they're the only bicycle shop in town? Because they're the only store within driving range? And to me, that makes the money a little faker, if I can say that. And so to the extent that I believe the economy can be a vehicle for good and money can be a vehicle for good, and dare I say capitalism can be a vehicle for good, because to me capitalism is a very basic thing. I think a lot of the layers that people attack are, I would categorize as advantagism. But I'm not going to split hairs on definition, because I did get into a nasty debate on Blue Sky where someone asked me to look at the Google definition of capitalism because I had it wrong. And I guess searching the internet is the authority of definitions now. But they're not wrong that my perspective is somewhat odd. And here's what it comes down to. Because I believe so much in democracy and the realness of money, where you get what you pay for or more, because essentially if you have to make money from what you've bought, it has to be a good deal. It has to, you know, you have to buy something that you are making more money on than you paid for. And to the extent that you pay and get less than you thought or less than was advertised, the money's, you know, a little faker. So looking at the idea of the reality of money versus the fakeness of money, I think that when people run profitable companies, that profitable company is more likely to be supported by a diversity of opinions because there's a diversity of customers buying things from that company. When a company is not profitable, it engages in the side of the economy that we tend to think is the whole economy, which is financial services. And I would catalog financial services as bank loans and investments and stock trading. What's very interesting about all three of these things is that they actually have very limited purpose for a profitable business. My understanding of stocks, and it's somewhat accurate, but you know this is where the asterisk part comes in, is that a company is the most interested in its stock price for two reasons. One, because it's reputational. It you know affects their credit score and it, you know people like it. But two, if they ever need to open up a round and sell a bunch of stock, opening up that round could have a negative effect on their stock. But as soon as it sells, it could have a positive effect. And that can be viewed almost as like a built-in credit card for the company. And as if the stock price is high, they allocate stock at that price. If the stock price is low, they allocate stock at that lower price. And then bank loans are for when a company does not have the cash reserves to fund their operations. They need to build a new plant or hire a new team or chase something. And both of these scenarios mean that for the operations of the business, the profitability of the company is insufficient. And again, it's somewhat ironic because, you know, building this product and not being at a place where I can sell it yet, I am in this category. And so I am engaging in borrowing while I am kind of taking a crap on borrowing. But what I'm getting at here is that the entire branch of the sort of economy that we call financial services is only extremely valuable to companies that are not end over end profitable. What happens to end over end profitable companies, I believe, is that they have a diversity of opinion in the revenue they bring in, meaning what they do is for customers and for the service of those customers. And it makes sense to figure out problem solving in that space. If a company is mostly bank funded or venture capital funded or chasing a stock price so they can sell it, so you can allocate more stock and have that as some income, they have this really odd conflict of interest to me, which is, do we listen to our customers or do we listen to the funnel of money that is coming in for us? And to me, that's the most undemocratic thing I can think of. Because you have the needs and demands of the people the customers actually serve. And this isn't even considering the employees. You know, employee fair or unfair treatment is an entirely separate conversation. We all know the pay wages is, you know, in the toilet here. But not even considering that issue, the idea that there are situations, and I've been at companies where there was like a problem with the system, like the homepage would take like 6 seconds or more to load, and there were all kinds of problems with the architecture, and we were having a really hard time getting things to function properly, and things that had taken a little bit of time at other companies take a long time. And I remember being in a conversation saying, "Hey, you know, we got to really like fix this system before we do the next thing." And the answer from the on high business layer was, nah, we need a bunch of features so we can chase a Series C. And that company's no longer around for the most part. And I remember thinking of like, so this is really weird because of all the customers of the company, all the things they needed, all the things we could have done to make the product work, we were more interested in a very small group of people's voices who are going to grant us further investment, even though that further investment was based on a product that barely worked. And so to me, this is the increase of the fakeness of money. And so I think that to the extent that an economy is derived from a small number of people who, I mean, money usually comes from a central bank to banks, and then from those banks, it goes out to customers. And the thing that's really the sort of asterisk on economics thing is I've done a whole bunch of like, watching videos and bouncing around. They're trying to figure out what is the relationship between the money that the central bank grants to banks and deposits. And what I can say from my research, and again, like not super specific, is that deposits are in fact not what is going out as bank loans. They have some role in whether or not defaulted loans cause the bank to close or like liquidity or some weird thing. But it does seem from the research that I have that in fact money flows from the central bank to banks and then out as bank loans. And what that means is that you have a small group of people giving money to a small group of people giving money to who they want, and that has a huge influence on the economy. And so that's the not so democratic version of economics. And I don't see a world where this economic system does not inevitably cause massive separations of wealth and poverty, for the simple reason that it doesn't spread around well. It's not like successful companies are companies that do things, provide things, and then those people take that home and do things and provide things. This sort of idea that accomplishment is less value than who you know is something that I fought against my whole life. People say, oh, it's not who you know, it's what you know. And I thought to myself, well, most of the people I know is because I talked about something that I was working on or something I was interested in. And so what I know is responsible for who I know. And that means it's all the same thing. But when you look at economics and you look at this idea of, you know, how spread out for actual realness products and services, and how much, you know, bank loans flowing in and, you know, crowning a few people, you understand why that phrase, it's not what you know, it's who you know, is tossed around. And it's been tossed around cynically my whole life. And that means that there's probably something there. So I wanted to start Compare Basic as the idea of a software company that increases this realness of money factor. So it spins up profitable teams that are may or may not be at some point supported by bank loans, but the idea is to have that involvement be incredibly minimal. And the technology is performing so well. It's everything I wanted and more. And the demo does run, but doesn't show a whole lot other than, hey, everything works together. But the plan is to spin up a few website products, you know, blog engines, corporate communications, all those kinds of things, and then spin up a data visualization product, and then begin spinning up just team after team after team. And what I want these teams to be building is not necessarily a specific product. And what I mean by a specific product is like a logistics application for the craft brewing industry, as opposed to a data visualization that lets you customize accounting practices to your industry. And if the difference wasn't clear, the difference is that I hope the products we build are configurable to fit whatever nuance you have, because I was just at the co-working space talking to someone who does vehicle logistics, and he's like, I'm in Excel. Like, all my tracking just happens in Excel because everything I find is so specific to some niche use case I don't have that I just, you know, I got to use Excel. And I think that what has happened essentially is that people have begun thinking so much about the specifics of a particular customer as the cleverness rather than the tools and the means of production and the configuration. So I really think that the Compare Basic system being something that strips back to something more understandable and kind of solves the sort of dependency library hell by having enough built into it that's flexible and understandable to begin with, and then also delivering products that are intended to sell in sort of like a very real and profitable way, and designed to arm people to use their skills in a very real profitable way, could very well start to sort of shift the tide of the sort of enshittification fakeness that we see in the world. And I realize that's so huge of an idea, it's hard to believe, but you need to believe. And what I had confidence the system would work, but it actually fucking works. So more to come on that. This may have been the most rambly, odd version of explaining what it is that I'm out here to do. I have so much hope that things are going to work, and I maybe you can relate to this. I am so frustrated that it is so hard to take root and is taking so long. And I gotta say, two things keep me going. Number one, this is not just happening to me. I mean, I'm excited to start this company, but I'm also spending every few months looking around saying, really? There's no other economic option for me? And I think that, and I hear stories all the time about how just absolutely crazy it is to, you know, with all the white collar layoffs. And so if you're listening to this and you're in that situation, know this, you may not have the comfort of life you had before. And you may be tempted to feel ashamed about some economic hurdle you can't cover that you expected to cover. And 2 years ago, that would be understandable. But today in 2025, you know, welcome to the party. Everybody's here. Everybody's here. And so I would say, let's make the most of it. But more importantly than that, as I have gone down into the system, I realized the reasons why it hasn't happened is because so many people told me to focus on a specific customer and not a runtime. Well, that kind of explains why we've been using the same, you know, main languages for so many years, because the number of people that must have gone down the path I was going and was just told by absolutely everybody to turn around is probably large. The other thing I've realized is that starting over is really, really hard. And, you know, they talk about some people have a stage fright that like rivals fear of death. Well, I think fear of starting over is one of those up there with fear of death things. Fear of starting over and fear of working together are probably two of those things. But one of the things that I really want to share is that I have a lot more compassion for why businesses have not done what I have chosen to do, which is rebuild a brand new software language and runtime from scratch, peeling back, you know, 30 layers of assumptions and going back to technology that was mostly, you know, developed in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s, and then bringing everything I know from my experience of what I've seen and heard in the industry. The reason I have compassion for this is that it is such an explosive process. I mean, I really wanted to rebuild things when I was at companies, but I also will be completely honest, I didn't really know the risks. I mean, there are times when I don't just break the system I'm working on, I break the ability to work on the system I'm working on, because the build system, the debugging system, the where am I system is the system. So, you know, there are reasons why the imbalances of the software industry are what they are. Starting over is very hard and very scary. And we have an economic system that is designed, if borrowing is more common than profitability, to funnel money to a few people. It's not accidental that that's happened, and it's also not necessarily some mischievous conspiracy. It's just the way that the numbers are configured. And realizing how massive this is makes it hard to face, but I think it actually is a solvable problem. And I think the solvable solution is the realness of money through selling real products and services that people get real value out, balances everything out. The fresh slate of a new system with learnings balances things out. And then, like everything else, believing in the human spirit and the human spirit in groups. You know, it's served everyone before in the past, and I honestly believe it will serve everyone again.